Sexy and Van City Radio may contain adult content. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM, CITR.
Oops.
Well, 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 welcome to Sexy and Van City Radio 101.9 FM on CITR. Or maybe you could be one of our podcast listeners. I guess you heard a little bit of that before the show. I don't know if you heard that silence. And that was Val and I actually playing a little bit of Twister as she was stepping out of the seat and I'm stepping into the driver's seat so we can start the show. Tonight's show, we're going to be chatting about something that you've probably been reading about in the paper a lot in the last few years. You've heard a lot about the Picton Trials, the Missing Women's Inquiry as well. And there's a lot of stuff going on about what should be happening in the downtown east side, what can we be doing to create safety with the women. There's a lot of things we could be doing. And I thought what would be really great is to bring in an expert, somebody whose opinion I really value myself and a lot of people, including the women in the downtown east side. He is a man who has spent a lot of time there, over 28 years. He is a retired constable for the Vancouver Police Department, and when he originally tried to retire, the women actually did a petition and had him stay on, and this was several years ago, which I thought was wonderful, which just shows how much they value him. And in a lot of the media and coverage that's gone on about the missing women's case, that's one thing that they've always said, even though there's been a lot of things about the Vancouver Police Department about it being negative, it's always been in regards to Dave Dixon, who I'm going to be introducing in just a moment, that he has always been really compassionate and really strong and a huge advocate for the women and the people in the downtown east side. So I'm very honored and very excited to have him on the show tonight. Welcome to the show, Dave.
No, thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I've known you for a really long time, since back in 2000 when I started volunteering at Wish Drop-In Center, which serves a lot of the women in the downtown east side in survival sex work. And I know that over the years there's been a lot of change in the east side, and you've been a huge, huge, huge support to so many of the women on so many levels. So thank you for all that work you do.
No, thank you for mentioning it.
You're welcome. So in regards to the east side, so because we get a lot of listeners sometimes, some are local and some are all around the world. So just if I could get you just to touch base in regards to just some of the core issues in the downtown east side, because it has been dubbed by the media as the poorest neighborhood in North America.
Well, it's always been, I guess, a magnet for people, you know, I guess from all over BC, maybe with different, you know, social problems, poverty, you know, a whole bunch of things, and that's why it's been dubbed the Poso Sporo Code.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess because all the services are down there, that also attracts, you know, a large number of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I mean, it's really unfortunate, and they've always focused the services down there for a whole bunch of different reasons, some political. And I mean, when the first needle exchange opened up down there years ago, the plan was to have some in other cities, but that plan fell through, and we ended up with the only needle exchange in North America down in the downtown east side.
Wow.
You know, so that's sort of what's happened and morphed over the years, you know, down there.
So there's multiple things going on. So sometimes when you say social problems, so there's addiction, sometimes mental health, violence against women. And I know I'm just touching on a few of the topics that go on down there, sometimes with the residential school system as well. There's quite a bit of stuff, isn't there?
Well, there is. It's a real mixture. And like I said, the downtown east side is quite different than any other sort of section where, there, say, there are other sex trade workers working. You know, the ones, I guess, in the downtown east side, a lot of them are actually born into the, you know the poverty, the addiction, a whole bunch of issues. So they really, you know, I hate to say it, but it's almost like they never have a chance.
Mm-hmm. So it's generational.
It is. It's for sure. And when I first came on the job in the early 80s, I was really upset when I went into some of these homes, and I remember finding one 10-year-old that was actually being sold by her mother.
Wow.
You know, and I still see that child today, and she's 36 years old, and thank God she's still around.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so angry, I think, at the mother. You know, but then as I got to know the mother more, I found out that she was raised in the same environment, and she really never knew any different. So when you say generational, it really is. So I found that I couldn't be angry anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And point my finger at any particular person. You know, so I know a number of kids over the years, and like I say, I've I had one girl today I talked to and see on a regular basis, and she was also 10 years old, you know, when I caught her in the backseat of a car. So it's, you know, and that's, you know, young, I know, but that, you know, there are younger ones, you know.
That was one of the things, and I know at one point there was rumors, and I don't know if this was true, but around Franklin Street, that at one point that was known as the kiddie stroll, that sometimes there were children as young as six, not on average, but it had happened.
I think so. I never heard of anything that young, but I mean, it's certainly possible, and the kiddie stroll was, I mean, it was famous. It was actually on the internet. We had people come from other countries, you know, just for the kiddie stroll.
Wow.
Unfortunately. So it's a pretty bad, you know, thing when you get known for a kiddie stroll.
Definitely, and I think it's surprising too, because I know a lot of our listeners and people that I talk to about the downtown east side, sometimes they're surprised where, when they think in terms of kiddie stroll, they think of Thailand. They don't think of something happening in Vancouver, right, in Canada.
No. No, you don't think of that, but I mean, it still goes on today too, unfortunately, and the people that say run some of these, you know, young girls, they're smart enough to keep them off the street now.
Okay.
You know, so they set them up in houses where they, you know, they have customers come in.
Wow.
You know, so it certainly still goes on, and very hard to catch.
Definitely very hard to catch. How is this cycle of recruiting in terms of, because if it doesn't happen generational, which does happen where a grandmother or someone in the family, or as you're mentioning, that young lady at the very beginning, the 10-year-old, where you saw it and it made you angry at the beginning, and then you understood where it is this generational cycle. When they're recruited in different ways, what are some of the ways that it happens?
Well, it's really simple. I mean, if you go to, you know, say a certain shopping mall and a food court, and I've done this, you know, just from my own sort of experience and to gain knowledge, and I've watched tables, you know, of young girls, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, and I can pick out the most vulnerable girl in that group.
Wow.
You know, because just by the fact that she's sitting back a bit, she's not joining in the conversation, you know, her body language, and so if I can do it, and that's what the kids do, and the sort of stereotypical pimp, it's not like, you know, you've seen the papers or the movies. You know, a lot of pimps nowadays are 14 and 15-year-old school kids, the males.
14 or 15 years old.
Yeah, they're recruiting the girls into the different gangs. I mean, so they'll see a girl like that, and they'll sit down and, you know, join her and start talking to her, and you know what? And it's as simple as them being friendly to her, and all of a sudden she gets hooked and she likes them, and you know, it's that simple. You know, you got a young girl that's never been, you know, known. She hasn't got a lot of self-esteem. The parents don't have a lot of parenting skills, so the relationship between the parent and the girl sort of breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
The girl is just looking for somebody to show some interest in her. You know, and it's really that simple.
And it makes sense too, because at that stage too, and I can see why it would be happening younger and younger with hormonally people are developing, hitting puberty earlier. And just not knowing whether you're a kid, whether you're an adult, who am I today? And just kind of going on that journey and somebody telling you that you're pretty and accepting you or seeming to accept you and telling you you're beautiful, that they care about you and making you feel good about yourself.
That's the big part of it, is just making you feel good for the first time about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the kids don't. I mean, when I say kids, I mean anybody. Even, you know, a lot of the women I work with, I mean, 30 years old, and that's a lot of what you do. I mean, you make the women feel better about themselves, because their days are so miserable. They really don't have something to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so beauty night is, and that's why I was always impressed with what you did, is because it sounds like a simple thing, making somebody feel better about themselves. You know, but it's not. It's a huge thing for the women down there.
I think they really do need an opportunity to feel good about themselves and connect.
Well, everybody does, I think. You know, and
it's,
I think,
a human
we take
need.
It for granted.
That is very true. We do take it for granted.
I mean, the life of one of the girls down there is basically consisted of trying to dodge, you know, the dealers, you know, because they owe money all day long, looking over their shoulders and trying to hide.
Wow. So how does a young girl go from when she's recruited by one of the guys, and you mentioned 14, 15-year-old pimps, and sometimes it's recruitment into a gang.
How is it done?
Yeah, how does it work from there, where they go from where they're... So they, do they get them experimenting just like how kids do, where they experiment, say, with pot, and for some cases where it gets a little bit harder, where it's coke or meth, different types of drugs, and then telling the girl that she owes money?
Yeah, that's one way. And the other way is just, you know, having the girl, you know, start get her to work. You know, you get her sort of hooked, and she's got no other friends, and you start to isolate her.
Hmm.
You know, and then all of a sudden, you know, they get them on the drugs, and they get them hooked, and then you need the money, and the only way they can get the money is by the girl going out and doing it.
So after a while, it's like what came first, the addiction or the almost emotional and physical violence and sexual violence?
Yeah, in a lot of cases, I mean, the girls were working already on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a real easy transition for some girls, especially the ones, you know, in downtown Eastside. Most of them come from a background of sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real simple transition to go to work in the street because now at least they're in control and they're getting money for it.
Yeah.
And when I mean sexual abuse, I mean years of it. I mean some of the kids that I've worked with, you know, some of the stories I've heard over the years. And I remember this one lady who I still see today. You know, when I first met her 20-something years ago, she just related the story. She comes from a small reserve way up north, and she had her first child when she was 10 years old.
Wow.
You know, unbeknownst to any medical people or anything, she had the child, and the father was her own dad. You know, while she went on to have another kid, one of the kids was from her uncle. Like, it's just a horrendous, you know, and I still see her, and then she actually still sees the first daughter. You know, but it just, I couldn't believe the stuff that this young girl had gone through. And she made a statement to me which always stuck with me, and she said, until I was 18 years old, she says, I always thought that I was just for sex because every male, I guess, up there had sex with her. And that always really bothered me and stuck with me all the years I worked down there.
Wow.
You know, what a horrible thing for a young, you know, girl to think. You know, so how do you sort of undo that, you know, that upbringing? I mean, she's doing actually really well, you know, now.
Mm-hmm.
She's got some health problems, but, I mean, you know, the life that she's led is just, I mean, it's sad.
It is really sad, and it makes me think not just with the East Side, with the missing woman's inquiry about all the horror, the violence, and just the truly horrific violence that many of the women go through, but also as well, and I know this is kind of a tangent, but also with Bountiful up in BC as well, where I'm just thinking in regards to the young girls.
Yeah, the Bountiful thing is a whole other, you know.
I know, it's another can of worms, but it does
and
make me think about it.
It's a lot different. You know, these girls are, as far as I'm concerned, being recruited at an early age,
Mm-hmm.
You know, and raised for, you know, these guys, which is disgusting. I think that we allow that.
Yeah. No, it's quite horrific, actually, and really sad that it happens in North America, where it surprises us because we don't see it all the time.
No, but I think, let's say, you know, we watch it on TV and it happens in some of the other countries, but it happens right here.
Yeah.
And we sort of tolerate it, I think.
We do, and I think we just don't know it exists as well. And it's interesting that it's gone more into the houses, because I know at one point I had heard stories about, especially along Kingsway in Vancouver, that there were girls, sometimes you'd see them around the bus stops and stuff, where sometimes they were sex workers as well. But they were, those ones were more early teen, but still quite young.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, most of them work up, you know, around Kingsway now, because there's no, you know, kiddie stroll per se anymore on Franklin.
Mm.
A lot of them are spread out along Kingsway, but if you were to drive from Vancouver and go along Kingsway, you'll see girls all the way right into New Westminster along Kingsway. You know, right along through Burnaby, right into New Westminster.
And
there's that many working up there.
Wow. And it's definitely not for the money, that's for sure, because the money isn't very good that many of the ladies get, because I think that's a misconception as well in regards to street prostitution.
No, there's so many girls out there, and especially, you know, with the downtown side again, because of the addiction thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking about $5 for, you know, for oral sex now. You know, and that's and the guys know that. Guys drive around looking for the deals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and then there's nobody standing out there making, you know, any amount of money.
Wow.
I mean, I've seen it for cigarettes, you know, now, because they really get desensitized to it, so it really doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing it, so that's really sad.
You'd mentioned earlier in regards to the pimps that sometimes they're as young as 14 and 15-year-olds. What would make a young boy become a pimp at 14 or 15 years old unless it was generational?
Well, just that, you know, the money, you know, the access to drugs. We had one guy years ago, he was still in jail.
Hmm.
He befriended a young First Nations boy. You know, I think the boy was 14 years old at the time, and the guy introduced him to drugs and money, and he had a fancy white BMW. And then he started asking the young kid if he knew girls that he could introduce him to. You know, so that's exactly what he did. He started introducing the guy, you know, to young girls and taking them back to the house. And the girls were as young as 12 years old. And these were all girls that were already semi, you know, sort of on the streets, you know, and dabbling in drugs and sex trade work. You know, so the guy ended up having these parties and videotaping all sorts of stuff. So this young boy was pimping, you know, the girls for this guy. You know, and he was doing it, of course, because of the money.
Wow.
And this guy had lots of money. He was given a salary by his parents who were down in California. They used to send him, I think, $50,000 a month just to sort of keep him up here and keep him away from them, I think.
Wow.
So lots of money, you know, lots of drugs, fancy car, and that's a real attraction for any, you know, young male.
In regards to, do they move the girls? Because you'd mentioned now there's a lot of girls almost in houses, and I don't know, body house would be the correct word to use for that, but do they move them from province to province still, or is that more of a myth?
The, you know, not usually the women we deal with downtown. There are some of the gangs and some of the pimps that will move them from city to city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's more of your stereotypical type pimp, 20 to 30-year-old male, you know, quite violent, sometimes hooked up with you know, different gangs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what they do. And then you're talking like escort girls or, you know, $1,000 a night girls.
Oh, wow.
You know, they'll move them if the heat gets too much. If the police are trying to focus on the girl, you know, the pimp will just move her to Calgary or somewhere else.
That's a vast difference from $5
yeah,
to $1,000.
Yeah, it's quite different. I mean, you've got, you know, girls on what they call high track, you know, down in Seymour, you know, making much more than that, you know, $1,000 a night. I mean, you've got girls up to $10,000 a night. You know, so then you've got a number of different agencies that, you know, nightclubs that are downtown that sort of facilitate that.
Wow.
You know, a guy flies into town, goes to the nightclub, and the nightclub makes a phone call, you know, to a certain girl. I mean, some of my kids that, you know, I worked with when they were young are working in the escort agencies. And that's all they do is they get a phone call, you know, from one of the, you know, the managers, you know, be at a certain place at a certain time to meet a client, you know, and they make very good money. One girl, you know, the kid that I knew, she was, actually, she mentioned one time when I was having coffee with her that she had her own driver. You know, and I said, what do you mean your own driver? And she said, well, somebody that, when I need him to go somewhere, I just make a call. You know, he comes and picks me up and drives me and stands by and waits for me. And I said, well, what do you pay him? And I think she said $25 an hour. And I said, that's not very much. And she goes, well, and that's for 24 hours, $25 an hour. He's on call, so she pays him for 24 hours a day, every day. You know, so if you do the math, that works out pretty good. It's like $500 a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But he's got to be there when she calls. He's got to be there within, you know, 20 minutes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how much money she's making. She can pay him $500 a day.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
In regards to the whole cycle, because there's obviously different levels in regards to prostitution, it's kind of unbelievable. Where do transgendered male to female sex workers fit in there?
You know, they usually have their own section where they sort of work on you know, Hastings Street, off
okay.
of Hastings. Yeah, but the same, you know, same sort of type of work. They're out there and you know, they have the regular customers.
Okay. In regards to safety for the women, there's been a lot of controversy about what to do, whether to decriminalize, whether to legalize, whether abolition. And in layman's terms, how would you describe basically the different options that they are? Because I know there's been a lot of confusion, I think, just in the general public about it, and all the sides are pretty heated.
Well, I guess I've never had anybody explain to me if they decriminalize it, how that's going to make it any safer for women.
Okay.
I guess that's my, you know, my bitch, if you want, is
okay.
You know, the last woman that was killed, sex trade worker that was killed in Vancouver, was an inside worker.
Hmm.
You know, but people say, oh, no, if we worked inside, and it'd be way safer. Well, it's not. The bottom line is it's a very dangerous occupation. You're going into a room, or you're hooking up with a guy that you've never met before. He's obviously, doesn't have a high regard for women because he's paying you to basically degrade you and abuse you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I just have a real problem when people say, oh, we should decriminalize it, it'll be way better. You look at, you know, Frankfurt, Nevada, you know, Amsterdam, it's legal over there, but yet they still have 300 working girls on the outskirts of the city, on the streets. You know, so
wow.
Nobody's ever been able to tell me how the girls on the downtown side who are, some are HIV, some are Hep C, you know, where do they fit into this master plan? And then the bottom line is they don't.
Hmm.
You know, so I just don't. And if you decriminalize it, it takes it out, you know, of the hands of the police, you know, where at least now the police sort of check them and they sort of, you know, keep track of them. And I don't think that would happen. If it was decriminalized, like in Frankfurt, for example, and I think the police chief over there made a comment a few months back that he's trying to get it back under control because it's so out of control.
Wow.
Because when they decriminalized it, it was an influx of entrepreneurs and you know, and call them pimps or whatever you want, you know, organized crime. You know, and it's huge over there now. And one of the worst aspects of decriminalizing, and I've got something, and anybody can do this if they want, go on the internet and you know, look up Frankfurt brothels. Take a look at some of the ads, and I pulled some off and I took them to some of the talks that I do. They have pictures of the women, you know, that they're selling. Some of the ads have comments like, the woman pictured above does not necessarily have to be the one you pick. We have better-looking women. You know, they refer to them as whores. They're absolutely the most disgusting ads, because that's what happens. If you're going to decriminalize it, you're going to desensitize it, and it's going to be like selling, you know, meat at a butcher shop. You know, it's really quite disgusting. So I think, and that's, you know, what happens is as everybody becomes desensitized to it and thinks it's okay. You know, and you know what? It's not. In any way, shape, or form, nobody was brought into this world, you know, to stand out there and sell their bodies. But, you know, the government, you know, allows it. We have 12-year-old kids standing out there, and we allow it to happen.
Why do we allow it as a society?
Well, I think nobody knows what to do with it, so they, you know, they turn a blind eye to it.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's a problem. That's why you have victims like the women on the farm.
Yeah. No, a lot of the women, it's... Tell me a little bit about the case, just in terms of... Just in terms of just painting a picture, in a nutshell, of what happened, basically.
Well, it's just a very extraordinary, you know, sort of the whole investigation. You know, I started realizing, I guess, because of my association with the organizations and the women on the street, which was fairly close, because even when they went into hospital, they would usually call me and let me know they're up there, because they knew I was always good for, you know, bringing up a hamburger or something or a cigarette. You know, so I was quite close to most of them. And I seen them almost on a daily basis. So I knew something was happening. I think around 97, I started realizing that some of the girls are gone. And I put together an original list, and I think that was the spring or fall of 97, and I submitted it to my inspector. And I had 31 women on that list. My inspector was very supportive and said, you know, and I explained to him, I had checked everything, and as far as I was concerned, these women had dropped off the face of the earth. And they hadn't passed away because I had checked at the coroner. So, you know, they just vanished. So my inspector was very supportive. He called a series of meetings, you know, and that's sort of where it started. You know, and as a result of that, they put together a review team, you know, the Vancouver Police Department did, and for 2 years we looked at that list of 31 till we could come to a conclusion, you know, or some kind of, you know, sort of where we could say that, you know, something was happening, but we still don't know what. I think we found four on the list of 31. Two had passed away, and two were still alive, but didn't want to be contacted by anybody. You know, and after that, at the end of that, we didn't know what else to do, so we asked the RCMP to review it and see what we had done, to see if they could come up with any other suggestions. And for, I think, a few months, it sort of sat, you know, in limbo, and then the RCMP decided to take it on. And that's when they took it on and expanded it. And that's when they, you know, introduced the, you know, the Missing Women's Task Force, and they expanded the search to include another list that I had, you know, that consisted of, I think there's 20-something bodies of downtown Eastside women that were taken and murdered and dumped in outlying areas.
Wow.
So they also took that on, too. So it's really, it's quite mind-boggling when you look at the scope and the number of people involved. And now, of course, they've taken in, you know, the highway tiers, too, and that's, I mean, it's just hard to put a number on it.
Tell me a little bit more about the Highway of Tears. In some ways, it reminds me a little bit of Juarez, Mexico, where there's a lot of missing women as well there.
Well, it's just, I think it's similar to, you know happened, you know, in the downtown east side, is that the women, you know, were just very vulnerable. They put themselves in really vulnerable positions.
Hmm.
You know, if they're out there, you know, coming from a late party, or coming just, say, let's from a friend's house to hitchhiking to another place on a highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're all by themselves, and unfortunately, you know, they met some predator that preys on, you know, the vulnerability of that. And that's exactly what happened with the women from the downtown east side. Because of their addiction, they got into a car with a guy and were willing to go out of their comfort zone, you know, to Coquitlam. You know, and that's really what it's about, is the addiction and the vulnerability. And unfortunately, there's a, you know, 1,000 guys out there that'll take advantage of that.
Wow. Who buys sex? Like, I know there's different types of sex workers. Like, there might be somebody, Johns, where there's somebody who's could be really, really super abusive, like the Robert Pictons, serial killers, people who, in terms of power, and then you've got someone who wants to purchase sex for the night where they don't want a relationship. Maybe they're very sick, or they're not very attractive, or they don't believe themselves as attractive, so it's easier just to pay somebody, so for almost for the girlfriend experience. Is what type of people actually purchase sex? Because I've kind of gone from one extreme to the other.
Oh, it's just about every race, creed, and color you can imagine, and every sort of, you know, I mean, you've got married men, single men, you've got men that want to find somebody that they can degrade, you know, because they can, you know. There was a trial 10 years ago, and the guy just recently got out of jail.
Hmm.
He was caught down on Crab Beach, and he was charged with, I think, a number of offenses with five different women, and my task was to try and get the women into court. And he basically paid them to torture him, and because of the crack cocaine addiction, you know, these women allowed him for as little as $20 to just do horrible things. You know, so this guy, and he flew under the radar. He was never checked by the police. There was no knowledge of him. You know, he'd been doing this for 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
You know, but that's, he preyed on the women in their weakest state. You know, and on the video, you could see the date and time. I mean, some of the women had been out with him before, but they agreed to go with him again because they wanted that $20 so desperately that they're willing to, you know, to let this disgusting person do stuff to him, which most people would find sickening. Even I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's just, it's everybody. We have I had one guy, I remember, that used to pay, you know, $1,000 for the women to burn him. You know, so you've got, well, I mean, you just have to watch the show. I think it was called Kinks that used to be on TV.
Mm.
You know, I just happened to catch it by accident one night flipping channels, and, you know, I mean, it's S&M at its, you know, worst, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people out there that like to be hurt, and this particular, you know, man, you know, paid big bucks, you know, for women to burn him.
Wow.
And he was quite, you know, he had quite a professional job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he always wore suits, and so nobody could see his burn scars, because apparently he was scarred his whole body from his neck down. You know, and I had a number of women that used to talk about him as a regular. So, I mean, it really, there's really all types out there.
Mm-hmm.
And the downtown east side, unfortunately, is plagued with the worst types because of, the, you know, the addiction and other things. I mean, if you were to go to High Track and try and do some of the stuff, you know, that you could do in the downtown east side, there's no way. The girls just wouldn't tolerate it.
What do you think the answer is? Because obviously it's not just Robert Picton. There's other people. There, I don't know if it's still called the bad date sheet, where the women actually report and it's shared, where it's printed out. I believe Wish actually puts it together, a list of just some of the people who do some horrific dates. So their version of a bad date is not like where the guy didn't pay for dinner. It's a lot worse than that. So.
Well, the Wish organization still puts the bad date sheet out, so that's if a girl has a bad date, and by a bad date I mean somebody that beats her up, robs her, does a date and takes his money back, any number of scenarios like that. You know, the girl lends a map van out there, you know, mobile access project, you know, van with a couple of women working it that are there for the women all night long.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll report it, you know, with a brief description of the vehicle, a description of the man involved. You know, and then they'll put it on a sheet and circulate it for the rest of the women. So that's handed out on a regular basis, so it's really important. You know, but, I mean, the bad dates, I mean, they certainly haven't slowed down. And that was the interesting part about that trial that I mentioned with this guy. When we got to trial, the five women, the defense lawyer, and after they watched this video of what they had done with this guy, you know, the defense lawyer asked him, would you consider him a bad date? And all five girls said no. And I was really shocked. You know, but you know why they said he wasn't a bad date? Because he paid. And that just, it really speaks to the level of violence that the women were willing to accept.
Wow.
You know, for the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed the women myself, and I said, would you have done that if you hadn't been addicted? And they said, of course not. You know, so it's just, it's really sad. And, you know, the crack cocaine has really changed the dynamics in the downtown east side. It's a horrible, horrible, you know, devastating drug.
So what do you think the answer is in regards to addiction? Because that seems to be playing a huge role in regards to street prostitution.
Well, I mean, they've got to start, you know, you look at other countries where, you know, they've been successful. They have great sort of recovery programs or treatment centers.
Okay.
You know, but every one of them that's successful is mandatory treatment. And we mention that here, and people say, or organizations say, oh, no, you can't force people to clean up. Well, of course you can. I mean, that's ludicrous to think that you can't force people to clean up. There's not one person in my 30 years that I've been down there now that ever made a conscious decision to go down there and, you know, be a drug dealer or a drug user or a sex trade worker. That, you know, that's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if you're out there using $300 or $400, you know, in cocaine a day, which isn't quite common, you're not going to talk to any youth worker or social worker about doing something with your life. Now, if you can take that same person and lock him up somewhere for a week, you know, to get through that, you know, whatever it is, heroin or cocaine withdrawal. And some of the, you know, withdrawals are pretty bad. Heroin is quite bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, I mean, you get sick to your stomach. You have the worst flu in the whole world. But after a week, you know what, you start to feel better. You know, and you start to, you know, to look better. Your face clears up. All of a sudden, you're willing to sit down with somebody and talk, you know, about your future. And that's the key, is you have to get them off that drug for starters. And now somebody that's qualified and somebody that gives a shit will come in and sit down with you and talk about your future. And that's when they'll start to make plans. So the mandatory, you know, treatment is a huge part of it. And that's not just a six-week program. If you look at even New York, they brought it in a few years back. Mandatory treatment, minimum 1 year stay.
Wow.
So you're not, you know, sort of just cleaned up and pushed back out there like we do here. We have six-week programs here. That doesn't even begin to touch the surface.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at that young girl I was talking about when she, you know, she had her first child at 10 years old. Here's a girl that was raised having sex with everybody, you know, every male around her. You know, so I mean, how do you undo that in a six-week program? You know, so it really has to be a minimum 1 year. In Italy, they have a place called San Patriano. That's, once again, it's a mandatory treatment. It's 1 year minimum, and it can be up to 4 years. You know, they give them skills. They build up their self-esteem. You know, they find them jobs. It's just, I think last I heard, 85% of the funding for the San Patriano comes from the products that they make in this, you know, treatment program. You know, so it's famous over there. So, but I mean, here, I mean, it would work here. But we have to stop, I think, talking about decriminalization and coming up with this attitude that, well, they're just going to work anyway, let's make it safer for them. I really get pissed off when I hear stuff like that. Let's try and find something for them to do when they're not out there in the street or in anywhere selling their bodies. I think I'm not a quitter. I hate to throw my hands up and say, oh, they're just going to be hookers anyway. You know, let's make it safe for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bothered by that. You know, I'd like to wave my magic wand on that and have nobody out there working the streets.
That would be really beautiful.
Well, I mean, I think it's possible, you know, but it's the same as drug addiction. If you look at the harm reduction, you know, that's going on the downtown east side, a number of people and organizations have basically bought into that and said, you know, they're always going to be addicts. You know, let's just make it safer for them. Well, you know what? That's a real defeatist attitude, I think. You know, once again, I mean, you have to, you know, sometimes force people to clean up. And that's what, when New York brought in their program, the mayor was at Rudy Giuliani.
Mm-hmm.
And his quote was, he says, one of the richest cities in America, he says, I will not tolerate, you know, drug dealers and sex trade workers on my streets, you know, of New York. And he went on to explain, he says, these people deserve a better life. You know, and so he got the cops, he got the police on side, he got the courts on side, he brought in his mandatory treatment, and he says, getting them cleaned isn't enough. He says, now we have to find out why they're out there in the first place.
Hmm.
And that's, you know, what the problem is with just about everybody. You know, something happened in the childhood, whether it's just poor parenting skills or poverty or addiction, you know, you have to fix that. You know, and it's a slow process. You know, and then once you fix that, then you've got to build them up with the self-esteem. You have to give them some training. You know, it's not just a sort of a six-month thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? At the end result is, you know, the person integrates back into society and, you know, works. They may not be making as much money as they were, but I tell you, they probably feel a whole lot better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I hate to give up on people like that. I think they deserve a chance.
No, I think everybody deserves a chance, and I think it's really important.
Well, I used to argue when I did talks, I used to tell people that nobody chooses to be a sex trade worker. But you know what? Now I can't say that anymore because some people are trying to push that. You know, that they want to stay. You know, because of the money that they're making, and you know, just everybody go away and let me do my thing. And for all intents and purposes, it really is already legalized. If you're working out of your own apartment, I don't think anybody's going to bother you. You know, I know people that are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Police are not going to come knocking on their doors. But now if you start running three or four girls or people at a hotel, then you're going to come to somebody's attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a different charge altogether. But if you're all by yourself, you look at the papers, how many escorts, you know, there's pages and pages, or hundreds of escorts.
And as long as they pay their taxes and business license.
Well, they're not. Yeah, they're not getting arrested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure what the vice squad, the numbers are, but I'm sure, you know, the sex trade workers that have been arrested are, you can probably count on one hand.
Mm-hmm. In regards to the missing woman inquiry, like, I know there were a lot of groups that were expecting to get funding to be part of it so they could be the voice of the women. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't agree with handing out funding to everybody, and that's where the difficulty comes in, because I'm happy that the families, you know, are getting a lawyer that's funded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but some of the organizations that are complaining, like, where do you draw the line? If you start giving funding to certain organizations, you're going to have 30 organizations come out of the woodwork.
Mm-hmm.
They're all going to want funding. You know, so I don't agree with, you know, funding everybody that wants to have a voice. I think the family's lawyer is going to be a voice. And somebody interviewed me last week about, you know, because knowing my police background, they asked me what side I was on. And that really, I guess the question really surprised me. I said, I'm not on anybody's side. I said, if I'm on a side, I said, I'm on the women's side. I'm certainly not loyal to the police department, even though I spent 28 years with them. I'm very critical of some of the stuff that happened and some of the stuff that they did. And I'll be certainly happy to voice my, opinion when it comes time. I mean, I'm looking forward to the inquiry in one aspect because of the misinformation out there. I want to clear up some of that, but I'm also apprehensive, and because every time I talk about it, I have a problem with it, because there's probably not a night that I don't go to bed where I don't see one of their faces, so I still have difficulty with it.
Of course.
So it's not going to be a happy thing to go through, but I'm looking, I'm apprehensive, but I guess I'm looking forward to telling the truth and getting it off my chest.
I'm just wondering, and I didn't hear if there was anything. I know up north they're doing a lot of community meetings in regards to, for part of the inquiry, and I don't know if there's any, or if they've thought about doing anything like that here, so perhaps with the groups, instead of having it with a lawyer, that it could be more of almost like a community feel, so there is some sort of closure that way.
Yeah, they could certainly do that. And I think Wally Opel and the other, the panel is going around BC now, hearing evidence about different things.
Yeah, because I know they're doing that up in northern BC. I was surprised how many towns they were doing it, and I was really glad about that. I think
it's funny, too, because, like a lot of people were screaming for this inquiry, and myself included, and now that they've got it, now they're complaining about everything else under the sun. So, it doesn't matter what you do, there are some organizations or some people that you're just not going to be able to keep happy.
True.
They've criticized Wally Opel, who I think is one of the most honorable men I've ever met. So I think he'll do the right thing, and it's not just him. There's two other people on the panel who are very well-respected people. So I don't have any issues at all whatsoever with, Wally Opel.
If you could wave your magic wand, what would you like to come out of this inquiry?
Well, I've talked to Wally before about this. I'm hoping that his recommendations have some teeth to them. Somebody in the government can do a follow-up 6 months later to make sure the police department and whoever else involved, has made some changes. Because, the sad reality is the police department, certain people, some of the officers on the street, there are many just terrific police officers that really give a shit. But unfortunately, there are some people in leadership positions that their opinion, the women hasn't changed one bit. And the women aren't being treated any better. You talk to the women, which I do every day. I'm out there from 5 o'clock in the morning on. The women tell me what's going on, and the violence level towards the women hasn't gone away, one bit.
Even with projects like the Sister Watch, etc., actually tomorrow will be the anniversary of Ashley's death from last year where she fell out the window.
Yeah. Well, I don't think she fell out the window, but
well,
it is working here.
I'm trying to be polite, I guess. Yeah.
No, that's it's a relationship between the police, and the street people, which has suffered, I think, and is not any better, where they can't go out there and question people. People aren't going to talk to them. And let's say 2 years ago when I left, I put some information in. About some women being, hurt really badly. One of the detectives went out to a hotel and he had a three-piece suit on. He was banging on the doors of the hotel, announcing his presence. By the time he found the girl, everybody in the hotel was so pissed off at her. She just wanted the police to go away, and she wouldn't talk to him.
Wow.
So that's just, it was really poorly handled. And then, of course, it didn't go anywhere. So certain members of the police, and these were senior detectives, didn't have a clue how to treat the women. So that's sad.
It is sad. So it comes down to basically not being able to treat them in a respectful way, where it almost turns into an us versus them.
Well, it does, and that was one of the keys in the missing women's investigation. One of the best tips we got. A certain detective went out there and did not handle it very well at all, and so the girl didn't talk to him, and that was the end of it. And as it turns out, the tip was an excellent tip, and that still happens. If you go out there and treat a girl like a, I hate the term, but crack hoe, and I heard this term used. If you treat her like that, she is not going to tell you anything.
but that makes sense with anyone. If anybody's treating somebody with negativity, it automatically, I think it's a human nature kind of thing where it gets your back up and you get defensive. And I think that's just normal. And especially if someone's got a history of being negative experience with dealing with other people.
Yeah, and most of these women, I mean, they're raised and they're sort of, it's inbred in them, being able to judge people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can read people in a second. So if you walk in with an attitude like that, you know, the woman will pick up on it right away.
Yeah.
And I tell you, the interview's over before it even started. You know, so that's where they have a lot to learn, unfortunately. And I say, here we are, what is it, 15 years later, you know, and they obviously haven't learned it yet.
Wow.
You know, so they have to work, you know, they've got a long ways to go on that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as the community, you know, sort of police aspect of it all. You know, I think they've dropped the ball big time, and they've really got a lot of work to do in that area. You know, so the recommendations are hopefully that Wally Opal and his panel make, hopefully they have some teeth to them where somebody can follow up, you know, somebody in the government can follow up and make sure that they're adhered to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like some more training, any number of different things. I mean, we still don't, here we are 15 years later after, you know, the investigation started, we don't have a 24-hour drop-in for the women.
That's true.
And I think that's appalling, you know.
No, it is, especially for the ladies down there, because there is so much violence. One of the things you brought up earlier, too, is many of the women are, because sometimes I think people have a misconception that sex workers are young, and even though we have a lot of young ladies there, there's a lot of women in their 30s and 40s as well in survival sex work.
Oh, for sure. I mean, we've got, you know, there's some in the 60s
mm-hmm.
still out there.
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, that's all they've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's really tough to get away from them, because every time they try and get away from it, but every time they're short on cash, you know, they come back down there.
Yeah.
And like I say, it's tough to make some extra money for rent, you know, if you're only looking at $10 a date. You know.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much, you know, sort of, you know, people out there, competition. You know, it's very tough to make any money. I mean, they'll stand out there for hours without a car going by.
Mm-hmm. And I know there's going to be some changes as well, which I think in terms of decriminalization, where it's treated as a job, and with labor law, et cetera, which puts it in a totally different thing, opens up a different can of worms as well.
Well, it does, and you've got a ton of organizations that'll scream bloody murder at you when you talk about legalizing it.
Mm-hmm.
They're very vocal. I've been to some of the meetings, and certain organizations just hate the term, you know, like you mentioned job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a job. You know, and they'll tell you a lot blunter than that, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got organizations fighting with each other about legalizing it, you know. And these are former sex trade workers that are screaming the loudest that, you know, there's no way they want it legalized, or even just the fact that you're implying that it's okay to be out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, I mean, the government's got to step up to the plate, too. You know, I mean, you know, to allow 12- and 13-year-old girls to stand out there and prostitute themselves is appalling.
Yeah, it really is, especially... Well, especially anywhere in the world.
Yeah. I mean, back in Montreal and Calgary, they've got the, you know, the Secure Care Act, you know, where if there's a 13-year-old kid standing out there, and if they're addicted and if they're working the streets, you know, they can actually, you know, force them into a program.
Mm.
And they call it Secure Care.
Secure Care.
Yeah, we just about had it here, you know, and it was actually on the table in legislature, but I guess the government changed at the time and it got put on the back burner and we never got it. You know, but I remember going to a meeting where people were screaming about, you can't lock our kids up. And I thought to myself, no, it's better to let them stand out there and work.
Hmm.
You know, jump into a car with a bunch of guys. I mean, it just made no sense to me. You know, it wasn't about locking kids up. It was about keeping kids alive.
Mm-hmm. What happens legally to a John if he's caught purchasing sex from a woman? Like, what is usually the process? Like, is it...
Well, they have a program called John Watch where he goes to... John school.
Okay.
And gets told that it's bad to do that, you know, which is a joke.
Because
the women used to get arrested, but, you know, the guy gets to go to school and gets slapped in the wrist.
Wow.
You know, so I don't agree with that.
Is that just...
That's who they should be focusing on, is the guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and arresting them and cutting off the... But at the same time, that's got to be sort of coupled with a program for the women, because the argument is going to be, if you take away the customers, the girls are just going to do something else to get their money.
Mm.
Or go underground. You know, so you've got to have more programs for the women.
So we need to do this right in terms of just making it safer for the women. A, we need exiting strategies for them, mandatory drug treatment, where they are getting training as well at
some
point.
Term stuff.
stronger changes in regards to with the Johns, so instead of just slapping them on the wrist and sending them to John school and punishing the women, that there's just men have to be way more accountable for it. So.
Well, for sure.
And in regards to moving forward, training, having some sort of more training in regards to anyone who is working with women who are dealing with violence. And I'm going to say men as well, because there are a lot of men in the downtown east side that I have worked with as well, that I found have histories of physical or sexual violence as well.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And I know that's something that doesn't always get talked about, which I think needs to actually solve the entire problem.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of guys out there, and I deal with a lot of my clients, you know, and same thing, they're subjected to a lot of abuse, and, you know, so there's no difference, really.
No, there's not. In regards to the downtown east side, 20 years from now, what would you like to see?
Well, that's a tough one. I've been there 30 years now, and I haven't seen any change, really. I hear people say it's better, but I ask them to show me where. I mean, there's since the Woodridge building opened up, you know, there's a lot more fancy little coffee shops and bars that have opened up around there.
Mm-hmm.
The people are still there. They haven't gone anywhere, unfortunately. So they're still, and they've still got their needles and their crack pipes, and, you know, so that hasn't changed one bit. The violence level is probably, as bad as it's ever been, if not worse.
Wow.
So I'd like to see the crowds go away. And if anybody thinks that's better down there, just go down there even right now at nighttime and walk through the Hastings, about 6 or 8 blocks,
mm-hmm.
around the main and Hastings area, and see the crowds of drug dealers out there and people, and it's really, it's a zoo. So, and that, if we wanted to, we could get rid of that, but we chose not to for some reason.
And how do we get rid of that?
Well, just a lot stronger police presence. The courts have to get on board, and start nailing some of these people, and like I say, mandatory treatment again, deporting the ones that aren't here, that are here illegally, just dealing here to deal drugs. That's a huge problem.
Is there still a lot of Honduran gangs?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you go down that corner of Columbia and Hastings and Cambie, right up to Cambie, but every corner there's a large amount of South American. That's all you can hear being spoken. So that's still a big problem. And I don't have any problem with anybody coming to the country. I'll open my arms and bend over backwards to help them, but not if they're just coming here to deal drugs, and that's what these people are doing. Yeah, but it's not just them. It's like, say, that there's... that particular 2 blocks from Main to Abbott Street is an absolute zoo of people. And they're all doing the same thing. But I say that, the police presence has to be far greater. The courts have to get on side and start nailing these people and then doing something with them. If that means mandatory treatment or whatever, but, they have to send a message. But right now, let's say if I'm from Honduras, I come up here, the standard money is I'm getting $500 a day to deal drugs. On top of that, I'm getting welfare, I'm getting medical, dental. Why wouldn't they come up here?
Wow.
And they're not getting sent home. They're here for a minimum of 2 to 3 years. So in the meantime, they're sending, the last estimate I heard was they're sending about $15,000 a month home. That's huge money for an 18-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm.
So you bet they're going to come up here.
Yeah. And I can understand that, too, because, again, it comes down to... it's just not just poverty here. It's poverty worldwide that's affecting...
Well, for sure, yeah. That's what's driving, bringing them up here.
Mm-hmm.
If you're coming from the Honduran bunch that we had, and I think they numbered probably 1,000 of them come up from a few towns down there, they were coming up in droves because there were people phoning down there saying, they're right, come up here. I'm getting $500 a day, and this. The money, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so easy because they have... they have a contact number to phone when they get up here. Usually it's a lady that runs a house in East Vancouver somewhere. When they get in the country, and they don't help them get up here, they just make their own way up. They make a phone call, the lady picks them up, takes them back to the house. The next day they go to immigration. They declare refugee status. Within a few hours they've got their paperwork. From there she drives them to the welfare office. They fill out papers, they get an intent to rent form. 2 days in the country, they've got a place to stay where the rent is paid. They've got welfare, they've got dental, medical. And the next day after that, they're down in Abbott and Hastings selling drugs. Making $200 a day and bonus on top of that, cell phones, pages. So they're phoning back home saying how wonderful it is in Vancouver.
And
that's a typical sort of scenario.
Wow. In regards to gentrification, that was one of the things that you brought up with the Woodward's building. There's a lot of kerfuffle with where the Pantages Theater used to be right now as well, where some of the community groups are getting up in arms in regards to that. gentrification good, bad, or a little bit of both, since it's, as you were mentioning earlier, that there seems to be the same faces down there regardless, even though there's prettier coffee shops, etc.?
Well, I think it's good because it brings in more people into the area.
Mm-hmm.
For starters, it cleans the area up. That Pantages Theater has been closed for like 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure why the people are so opposed to it opening up.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's funny because they say, "Oh, we've lost all this housing." You know what? We've gained a lot of housing. The government now owns 24 hotels down there, and these are all for people down there.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure where that we've lost all this housing, but it doesn't matter what. Every time somebody wants to do something, people are opposed to it because they want that to go to houses, SROs. It's just, I don't think that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Because look at the hotels. A lot of the hotels down there are in horrible shape. They're not run very well. So I like to see something like the theater open up. Same as the Woodward Building, that's rejuvenated that block down there.
Mm-hmm.
And when the south side of the Hastings across from Woodward gets opened up and gets going, I think that'll help that too. But they've got to clean up some of the hotels down there, for the people, and have other options for people that want to get away from the drugs. And right now that's a real difficult thing to do down there, because most of the hotels are what they call low barrier.
Mm. That's true, and I know that there's been places opening up. I heard rumors of one that was opening up for teen girls as well, which I don't know if that's true or not.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Jackson and Alexander. There's a big uprising in the community about it. A lot of organizations are opposed to it.
When when an organization applies to run an SRO, whether or not it be for teen girls, how does that go through in regards to with the city? Because I'm just wondering about it, because it looked like they, just from what I've read about it, it seemed to have gotten approved almost a year ago beforehand. And do they keep that stuff open, or how does that work?
I'm not really sure, because it looks like this got rubber stamped without a lot of process to it, because a lot of people were surprised.
Hmm.
That they've done it, but I mean, people are finding out about it, and they're getting more sort of outraged, and there's petitions going on, there's a number of things going on, against this proposal to put young women down there.
Mm-hmm.
Myself included. I just think Mark Hasek from the Vancouver Courier did an article about 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Which was quite good, and he interviewed me, and I just told him it doesn't end well. He said, "What do you think about women being placed down there?" And I says, "I'm dead set against it, because I know how it's going to end." You can't take a 15 to 19 year old woman and place them in the downtown east side and expect it to end very well. And the argument is that, well, they're just hanging around down there anyway. Well, if my daughter was hanging around down there, what am I going to do, buy her a condo down there? That's just brain dead, I think. And they say, I think that the thing they're saying is that if they're staying in there, then we can work with them and help them exit. And my first question is, exit to what? What it does is taking the pressure off the Ministry of Families, to open up proper housing. And that's one of the big issues right now, is that there is no proper housing. As far as I'm concerned, proper housing doesn't mean housing them in the downtown east side. That particular block, is full of predators. I mean, they're going to be circling, that building like eagles. So that's a horrible idea. There's a number of meetings coming up in the next week about it.
Are there any that any of our listeners can go to that you know of? If they want to get more involved or find out more about it?
Well, they can certainly phone the city and ask them what's going on with the proposals. It's 120 Alex, or 120 Jackson is the address.
Okay, 120 Jackson.
Yeah, and the proposal is to put house women, 15 to 19 year olds, in there.
Wow.
And if they're not addicted when they move in there, I guarantee they will be, within a month. And that's, I think it's just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to get involved, I mean, get a hold of the city and find out what's going on. The Ministry of Families is another one. Find out why they're involved and why they're going to allow it.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there were several petitions as well. Is there anything that you know of where people can contact, where they can sign something if they wanted to?
Yeah, the Raycam Community Center.
Raycam Community Center.
Yeah, they're at 900 East Hastings. There's a program that's run out of there called Alive.
Okay.
And they're the ones that are circulating the positions.
Okay.
But there's a number of Aboriginal groups. I think, Young Mothers is up, petitioning against it. There's a whole bunch of people that are against it.
No, it's yeah, there shouldn't be women down there that young. Well, there shouldn't be women, no. Period, where it's unsafe.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, the ministry should be, you know, housing them, you know, or providing housing for them away from the downtown east side.
Mm-hmm. In regards to with the missing women's inquiry, where else would they find out other information if somebody wanted to come to one of the meetings, find out more?
You could probably go on the internet.
Okay.
And inquire in the panel. I'm sure they've got their agenda there somewhere.
Yeah, they do have a blog as well, so I can always add the link to my to the interview afterwards. So yeah. I can definitely do that.
And I'm not even sure when the inquiry starts here in Vancouver. You know, myself.
I'm not sure either. I just know from looking online, they had a lot of the stuff for this week and for next week is all up north in terms of a lot of the community meetings. So if you're not in Vancouver, there's a lot of great stuff going on. So including one tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the best thing that'll come out is just over the last 5 years or even longer, there's just been so much misinformation out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's one thing for me. I think that'll, you know, help me personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, I mean, you know, every time I hear that, you know, somebody said that the police didn't care, that's one thing that's always bothered me. There's a lot of great police officers out there that really do care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, I mean, unfortunately, the system, and there's a whole bunch of other, you know, politics that get involved, and sometimes it doesn't move forward as it should. So I think this will help bring a lot of that out. And I'm not sure if the families will be, you know, happy with what comes out or you know, it's going to be a tough one.
Mm-hmm. So what's next for you?
Nothing. It's the same old down there. I've been down there 30 years, and I still love working down there. And, mm-hmm. and we were just talking about today, one of the young girls that I've known for years. You know, they're even the some of the dealers, you know, and the users are very appreciative because I'm usually down there by 5 in the morning. You know, I can talk to them. You know, if we have beds open, the organization that I work with. If there's a bed open, I can drag somebody back and offer them a bed and 3 meals a day and try and get them more stable housing. I've usually got snacks, and I've usually got cigarettes and some other supplies. And you know, the people are very appreciative. Well, at least once a week, somebody will tell me how much they appreciate me being out there. And for me, that's, you know, that's what it's all about. I just, you know, it's still very rewarding for me. And so I got no intentions of going anywhere.
And if anyone's curious in regards to the downtown east side, tomorrow's probably a really great day to go down, as is every day, to come check out. There is the Alley Health Fair going on as well from 10 to 2 from Main and Hastings, curving around Columbia. So I will be down there myself, actually, at 166 East Hastings, actually, in the old health contact center.
Oh, okay.
So I will be there tomorrow as well. So Alice... So anybody who is listening who wants to come out and find out a bit more, talk to some of the groups and make your own decisions in regards to what is the best thing. Perhaps it's a good opportunity to come down and see some of the health and wellness opportunities for everybody down there too.
Well, it's one thing, you know, the positive side of down there, there's always been a real sort of a community spirit down there, because I did a talk yesterday for a school and one girl just didn't complain, but she pointed out, well, there's a real community down there. There is. I mean, there's a lot of people that live down there by choice, and there's a real sort of community spirit. People are very helpful, but unfortunately, there's this other side of the downtown east side that's always portrayed by the media, you know, because it sells papers, I guess. You know, they want to see the gritty, you know, people fixing and all that. So it's unfortunate that that's the only part that's sort of portrayed, you know, but that part hasn't changed, like, say, in 30 years. You know, the choice of drugs may have changed, but nothing else.
Oh, that makes sense. Dave, thank you so much, because I know you're up so early in the morning as well, for taking the time to chat with me tonight. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And I'll be lucky enough to get to see you tomorrow and to give you a hug in person.
I'll be down there.
Yay. And listeners, thank you so much for listening in, and really think about what do you think is right for the downtown east side in Vancouver, and how can we change this world to alleviate poverty and make it a better place for men and women, and really think about what are the right decisions, and really talk to people, find out more for those like Dave Dixon who have been there, who actually walk the talk, basically, or talk the walk. I don't know how to describe that quite right, but basically, who knows what he's talking about. So talk to people, find out more information, and make your own choices, but really think about it, because there's some really great people out there who have a lot of knowledge to share. So let's change this world and make it a better place. You've been listening to Sexy in Van City Radio on 101.9 FM on CITR, and I think, Dave, you had one more thing to say, and
I'm very easy to get a hold of. I mean, get a hold of me to the Raycam Community Center anytime they want. My cell phone's available there all the time.
That would be perfect.
If anybody's got any questions or something they want to clear up, I'll be more than happy to respond to them.
Or if they want to have you in for a speech, because you're a wonderful speaker.
No, thanks.
You're welcome. And up next is Hans von Claus's Misery Hour. He is a very sexy man to be miserable with. He will be guiding you through the wee hours with his ambient music and his super hot voice. You've been listening to Sexy in Van City Radio on 101.9 FM on CITR. We will be back next week at the sexy hour of 10 o'clock. Have a wonderful night, everyone. Bye-bye.
It's new. It's exciting. It's the Sounds of Africa. For the Sounds of African music, join me, Sheila Sam, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9:30, right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. From soukous to reggae, some juju, some jazz. From North Africa to South Africa and the African diaspora, I got you covered. Enrich your musical knowledge and taste as you savor the sounds coming from the Sahara right across to the Kalahari, right here on CITR 101.9 Vancouver. Tune in for the unique sounds of Africa. Start your day right with the beat and the rhythm of Africa. With the beat,